Hi, it's Mountain Edition, all the news from the week here in the Roaring Fork Valley. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. This week, we tag along on avalanche training with crews who keep the roads safe all winter.
Voters in Basalt agreed to pay more for cigarettes.
And Basalt and Carbondale will both see some fresh faces alongside returning members of town council.
Plus, short films pack a big punch for the 27th year.
The biggest stories from this week coming up on Mountain Edition. Results are in for Tuesday's elections in Carbondale and Basalt. Carbondale's mayor, Dan Richardson, will continue for four more years, as will current trustees Erica Sparhawk, Heather Henry, and Luis Yanis. Lonnie Kitching will join the town's board of trustees for a two-year term. Carbondale voters also agree to another decade of an existing mill levy, which will fund street improvements, downtown parking, and streetlights.
In Basalt, voters decided to follow Aspen's lead and tax cigarettes and nicotine products sold in town. Ryan Slack, William Infante, and incumbent Gary Tenenbaum will fill the three open seats on Basalt's town council.
Construction kicked off Monday on the Castle Creek Bridge and Hallam Street in Aspen. It means traffic delays and detours, and it also has environmental impacts.
At a city council meeting last week, neighbors raised concerns about how the construction could affect Castle Creek, like debris and runoff polluting the stream. There's also lead-based paint on the hand railing across the bridge that will be removed. Mark Gould of Gould Construction says they'll take those off-site to be sandblasted. Gould said they'll take measures to protect the water. He said it would be like creating a bathtub around the work zone to capture runoff. Gould Construction was also a contractor on the Grand Avenue Bridge project in Glenwood Springs.
In a 17-17 vote, mostly along party lines, members of the state Senate did not expel Republican Senator Randy Baumgartner, who represents Garfield County, over allegations of sexual harassment. Benta Berklin has more.
The vote is a stark contrast from last month's successful expulsion vote in the House against former Democratic Representative Steve Lubsock. In the Senate, all but one Republican felt the evidence wasn't strong enough, and the investigators' report too thin. Baumgartner denied the allegations against him and says he's remained quiet to protect the integrity of the process.
With very few exceptions, this has been the most difficult and humbling experience in my life. It has been torture to hear accusations made that I could not answer.
While addressing the chamber, Democratic Senator Nancy Todd of Aurora says the Senate must hold their own accountable and stand up for victims.
Please do not dismiss her. Please do not make it sound like she just made it up.
An independent investigation concluded in February that it appears more likely than not that Baumgartner slapped and grabbed a legislative aide's buttocks multiple times in 2016. Two other sexual harassment investigations against Baumgartner are expected to be final next week. I'm Benta Berklund at the State Capitol.
The second phase of Aspen Art Museum's year-long exhibit, Ritual, opened yesterday. The museum celebrated with a changeover event related to the work of one of the artists on display. Arts reporter Kristen Kay has more.
A selection of Ann Collier's aura photography will be part of the new iteration of Ritual. This type of photography relies on hand-built cameras that can purportedly capture a person's energy field. Last week, Christina Lonsdale from the pop-up aura photography studio Radiant Human was on hand, photographing museum goers.
What this is able to do is translate your body's electricity so that we can see it.
Right, this is who you are in this moment in time. Very true to photography.
The second phase of Ritual displays work from Collier and four other artists exploring spiritual and religious rituals. The exhibit includes Meshach Gaba's Memorial for Drowned Refugees, a piece based on a West African ritual for drowned sailors, and Chris Martin's Mandi 9, which will involve a daily minute of silence at the museum. Kristen Kay, Edlis Neeson, Arts and Culture Desk.
Colorado's annual budget bill is making its way through the State House and is now in the Senate for debate. It already cleared the Democratic-controlled House.
A strong economy has meant more money for state priorities, such as roads and schools. Benta Berklin breaks it down with State House reporters as part of our weekly Capitol conversation.
Joining us today, we have Ed Sealover with the Denver Business Journal and Brian Eason with the Denver Post. Brian, it seems like there's something in here for everyone to like.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this budget debate has been a huge difference from years past. Lawmakers got $495 million for transportation. They got $150 million to boost annual school funding. And they got $225 million set aside to help with pension debt. Alongside that, on Wednesday, there was this hours-long debate where lawmakers were getting money for this or that. There was some money for drug treatment, for youth services, and for school security. So yeah, pretty much every special interest under the Golden Dome got some money.
And now it heads to the Senate, Ed, where we heard from the top Republican in the Senate, where they have the majority. He doesn't think there's going to be a lot of changes in that chamber, and he's pretty satisfied with the budget.
The trick is, he was satisfied with the budget that he saw before it hit the House on Wednesday. They tacked something like 32 amendments on there, Christmas treeing it up for every special interest program they could. I think there are going to start to be some battles over that. How much money is going to go to things like school safety or to environmental programs, or will any money go to film incentives? But the general substance of the budget will stay. Now, the biggest trick to this, though, is that, as Brian mentioned, there's $495 million going to transportation, but only 35% of that is going to go to state highways under what the Democrats passed. The Republicans in the Senate have said, I want to put that all to the state highway system. I don't want to put much into transit. I don't want to give any of that to cities and counties. I think that's where you're going to see the biggest fight, and that's going to be the continuing battle over how we fund transportation in this state.
One of the interesting wrinkles of that transportation money is that split between the state, local governments, and transit, that only takes effect if Senate Bill 1 fails. So there's still going to be these negotiations going forward of, you know, what does a transportation bill look like in this state?
Ed, do you think this debate this year seems a lot different to you than years past? You've covered the legislature for a long time.
Even last year, and this has been typical of most of the past decade, the debate has been about what you cut, who's not getting what they want. This year, the debate was just about how much largesse you want to put into various things. It was especially after the newest budget forecast showed that the state was going to have a $1.3 billion surplus in next year's general fund. It wasn't a question whether education was going to get funding, whether transportation was going to get more funding. It was just a matter of how much. So whereas I think in the past, the budget was more about what the state could do on limited resources, this year's budget is a little bit more about what are truly our priorities and what are we willing to put money to when we actually have that money.
I think having more money really affected the tone of the debate. I mean, you didn't see these, you know, partisan tensions boiling over into, you know, late night filibusters or anything like that, which is kind of funny, right? Because it's an election year. I mean, we expect that stuff this year of all years. It's amazing what actually having money will do for people's mood.
Thanks, Brian Eason with the Denver Post and Ed Sealover with the Denver Business Journal. I'm Benta Berkland, and this is Capital Conversation.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Allison Bektesh.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. And Allison, we know the people listening to Mountain Edition want to stay informed about local news.
Absolutely. One of the ways you can do this is by visiting Aspen Public Radio's Facebook page, where you can get updates on the latest news from across the valley.
You can also interact with our station through comments on our posts and by messaging us directly.
This week, you can see photos of Pickens County's road and bridge crews doing avalanche beacon training.
Check it out by searching Aspen Public Radio on Facebook.
Aspen Film's 27th annual Shorts Fest started Tuesday. There are 11 programs, each comprised of animated films, documentaries, and comedies and dramas from all over the world.
Each program is designed to challenge viewers by including films with a variety of lengths, styles, settings, and themes. As arts reporter Kristen Kay found, audiences will discover for themselves imagination and even some weirdness in these little films on the big screen.
Susan Rubel, the executive director of Aspen Film, remembers seeing her first short film in college.
And there was an eye being sliced with ants crawling out. I think everybody sees it when they do a cinema studies program.
Not all short films push the envelope quite that much. Shorts are constrained by time. They have to clock in at 40 minutes or under. So the filmmaker needs to make careful choices.
Even though everything in a feature-length film is done and specifically there for a reason, there are no shots that are accidental, there's no sound that's accidental, I think you have to do that even more so with a short film.
Their shorter running time demands creative storytelling, and often shorts are fertile ground for experimentation. Their shorter length makes them a powerful way to expose audiences to something new. Landon Zackheim is the new director of programming for Aspen Shorts Fest.
Oftentimes, you'll see some incredible work from feature filmmakers who have either been frustrated by how slow the process of getting their next film is made or you know, just haven't been able to kind of make what they want to make. They'll take out that kind of stifled creativity on a short.
He says because short films require less money and time to make than feature-length films, there's far less pressure and interference, and so filmmakers can take more risks. He and his team culled the 77 films that will be screened this week out of about 2,500 submissions. And matchmaking the films to create those programs is an art form in and of itself. After deciding which films made the cut, Zackheim crafted the 11 individual programs. He didn't want to allow audiences to get too comfortable in their plush velvet seats.
We like to think of it unofficially as something of a roller coaster method, where it's you, if you're going to one program, you should see a number of unique worlds and be introduced to a whole diverse range of things that can happen in shorts.
New technologies are helping that range grow wider and wider. Instead of spending thousands of dollars on film school, an aspiring filmmaker can watch online tutorials. If you have a smartphone, you have nearly everything you need to shoot your own film.
You can replace a crane shot with a drone shot. There's a lot of scope you can add. It's easier than ever to make special effects.
There are also more options than ever before for distributing and viewing films. A filmmaker can post their film online. Some video hosting sites even partner with studios on exclusive releases. People can watch award-winning shorts on subscription services like Netflix and Amazon Prime Video. This means that short films are getting more respect than they used to. Ronaldo Marcus Green is a juror at Shorts Fest this year. He's made both feature and short films. He says some short filmmakers are dipping their toes into genres and techniques that used to be exclusively feature film territory.
People are pushing the envelope in terms of like camera movement and camera work. So as the cameras evolve, as the technology evolves, you're seeing more, you know, more films with a little bit more pizzazz.
Green's short called Stop premiered at Sundance in 2015. The film took just 2 days to shoot, but it took him 6 months to write the 6-page script. He says a film needs more than special effects. Good old-fashioned storytelling is still the foundation.
I think the hardest part about making short films is writing them. It's because you have so little time to tell a story. So I think the real writers are the ones that will be the ones that are successful.
At Aspen Film, Susan Rubel acknowledges this too. Even with all the innovation in the shorts world, she's primarily concerned with showcasing films that are just good films. She wants festival goers to appreciate the craft that goes into shorts and learn something too. Kristen Kay, Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
Critics of Colorado Senate President Kevin Grantham said he's been inconsistent, even partisan, with his handling of sexual harassment allegations at the State House. This, they say, raises concerns about his ability to be fair and help change the culture at the Capitol. Venta Berkland has more.
Kevin Grantham meets with members of the media every Monday morning in his office at the State House. It's a time for reporters to ask him about policy and other matters. And for almost 3 months, he's been answering questions about sexual harassment allegations filed against 3 Republican senators. Then, during the March 19th meeting, Grantham brought up concerns about a Democrat. He said Senator Daniel Kagan is known to habitually frequent the women's restroom.
You want to talk about a uncomfortable workplace environment or whatever the terminology is. We have people that don't feel safe going in there without going in with somebody else.
Later that day, Republican Senator Beth Martinez-Humenic filed a complaint against Kagan. The restroom is private for staff and senators, and while it's commonly known as the women's restroom, the door isn't marked. Kagan admits to going in once, but also denies doing it multiple times.
It was an innocent mistake, and to try and blow it up like this.
Under the General Assembly's workplace harassment policy, Grantham is the one in charge of investigating the complaint against Kagan, or hiring an outside firm to do it. Grantham would also determine if punishment is merited.
Some people will perceive bias and unfair treatment because of the president's prior comments on this case.
That's Jennifer Drobak, a law professor at the University of Indiana and a national expert on sexual harassment in the workplace. She says Grantham should recuse himself.
Deciding that someone is guilty before an investigation's been done really suggests that he has an agenda.
When sexual harassment allegations against three Republican senators were found credible, Grantham didn't say if his colleagues had acted inappropriately, but called the independent investigations flawed. Asked if he would recuse himself from handling the Kagan matter.
I will just have to look into it.
Grantham has also made contradictory statements about when lawmakers and staffers should be telling their stories to the media. Last month, he said they all play by the same set of rules, and he was critical of a male staffer who went public after filing a complaint against Republican Senator Randy Baumgardner for creating a hostile work environment.
A staff member went to the media first and absolutely broke the rules as we all agree to live by. Didn't even allow the policy to be in effect for that situation, trying to create a media storm out of it. So that's a little bit upsetting.
But a month later, when Martinez-Humenic filed her complaint against Kagan, she came to us with the story, and Grantham didn't say she broke any rules.
Like many accusers and complainants, she has availed herself of the press, like many of them have. It's a fine line, and that's why I'm not speaking about it now, because the complaint was filed.
That leaves the staffer, who wishes to remain anonymous for fear of losing his job, feeling like there's a double standard. Others find the remarks unsettling. Erin Hottenstein is with the group Colorado 50-50, which seeks to elect more women to office.
President Grantham is treating a member of his own party a certain way and treating a staffer who made a complaint against someone in his own party a different way. And that kind of inconsistency really shouldn't be happening. It makes the process look partisan, and this process should not be partisan at all.
The harshest criticism is still coming from Senate Democrats over Grantham's handling of Baumgardner. They're calling for Baumgardner's expulsion after allegations that he grabbed and slapped a former legislative aide's buttocks multiple times were found to be credible. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart Severy. In other Aspen Public Radio news, Aspen is the only city in the Roaring Fork Valley without a Cultural Arts Commission, but that could change.
Aspen officials want to sit down for a long conversation about drought, water storage, and river health.
And the annual budget bill is making its way through the state legislature.
Those stories and more news at our website now. Take a listen at aspenpublicradio.org.
Several Native American tribes convene in Aspen this weekend for an annual powwow. Arts reporter Kristen Kay has more.
Members of the Hopi, Navajo, Cheyenne, Lakota, Ute, and Cherokee nations will perform traditional songs and dances in full regalia for the gathering on Saturday. Deanne Vitrick-Kessler, founder of Aspen Ute Foundation, says that this year's exhibition is a show of unity.
The goal is to really bring the communities together of the tribal members from the different reservations and the local community or the tourists. So we realize that we are all related.
Audience members can even join the dancers for some parts of the powwow, like the social round dance. Aspen Mayor Steve Skadron and Councilman Burt Myron will be honored for supporting an effort to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. The powwow starts at 3:30 on Saturday at Wagner Park. Kristen Kay, Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
A team of researchers from the University of Colorado have developed a new instrument to detect methane leaks.
Oil and gas companies are required to monitor for methane, a potent greenhouse gas. The current practice only captures a snapshot in time. About once a year, someone drives out to the site with a camera that can spot methane gas to detect any leaks. Caroline Alden is a researcher at CU Boulder's Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences.
These leaks are not necessarily on all the time. They can be intermittent.
So it's not clear how often leaks go undetected, but Alden and a team of researchers think they have a solution. They've developed a new field instrument that uses lasers to detect methane leaks from miles away. It can be set up for days or weeks at a time to collect nonstop data and can monitor multiple operations at once. The technology is based on Nobel Prize-winning laser research at CU Boulder in the early 2000s. It's now being tested at two sites in Colorado.
Governor Hickenlooper has signed a bill that will provide funding to expand high-speed internet in rural areas of the state. Supporters say fast internet service is critical for telemedicine, public schools, and farmers. Democratic Senator Carrie Donovan, who represents Eagle and Pickens counties, is also working on other measures to improve rural economies.
It is surprising to have seen the progress we made this year after hitting so many dead ends over previous sessions. So it's very exciting, but we can't stop here. We still have more to do, but this is a great start.
The bill will take money from a fund that has subsidized rural telephone service and invest it in broadband construction over a five-year period ending in 2023. It's estimated that more than $115 million will go into broadband grants between 2019 and 2023.
Pitkin County is looking to update its regulations on waste disposal. The current solid waste hauler ordinance was last updated in 1991. County staff says trends in waste disposal and management have changed significantly in the decades since. The new ordinance considers a pay-as-you-throw system for both trash and recycling, as well as requirements for curbside recycling and improving enforcement. It also aims to align with the City of Aspen's policies. The county hired a consultant to work on developing the new ordinance and worked with other local governments, as well as seven of the private waste management companies that serve Pickin County.
Writ Large, a Roaring Fork Valley storytelling series, comes to Basalt tonight. Kristen Kay reports.
In what's called a story slam, people take the stage to tell true stories without relying on notes. Rosemary Watola Trommer, a poet from Telluride who is participating in tonight's story slam, says the ancient art form of storytelling is experiencing a resurgence. She credits this to a culture that's growing increasingly isolated. This means that, right now, people are craving connections.
And when we hear that kind of authenticity, it sends off bells inside us, right? It's like, oh my gosh, that's it for me too.
Trommer will be joined by five other Colorado storytellers, including several Valley locals, for Thursday's event at The Temporary. Kristen Kay, Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
Pickin County's road and bridge crews keep the roads clear and open during even the nastiest of winter storms. And while doing it, they often have to drive through areas that are prone to avalanches. Each year, the crew goes through avalanche beacon training with Mountain Rescue Aspen. This year, Elizabeth went along.
On a dark, snowy evening a few winters ago, road and bridge supervisor DJ Hughes went to work up the frying pan. There was a slide covering the road at about mile marker 16.
Cleared that slide and was coming back down towards Basalt.
When another avalanche hit the road in front of his truck.
I stopped. I was backing up, and as I was backing up, there was more snow coming in behind me.
Hughes is calm, recounting that night. He sat in his truck between the two avalanches that each covered a lane and a half of the road and called into dispatch. Admittedly, though, it was a little scary.
I was a little on edge myself. I wasn't sure how much more was going to come down, wasn't sure what the conditions were above me, and that's why we have our radios to let everybody else know where we're at and what's going on.
Hughes was able to clear the slides and make it safely back down the narrow road. But in the intervening minutes, it was
very comforting knowing that I have that other person on the other end of the radio that knows I could be in danger. And with our training and stuff that we do with the beacons, they'll find me.
All right, are we ready?
We're ready.
All right, just off into the field.
The training put on by Mountain Rescue Aspen covers the fundamentals, and they spend time practicing in the field,
okay,
too.
Okay, now what are we going to do?
Pickens County's road and bridge crews plow and maintain 140 miles of roadway, and their routes include several areas that see regular avalanche activity. Bruce Gordon is a volunteer with Mountain Rescue and has been helping with these trainings for several years.
It's really a critical situation with we're having bigger snows, wetter snows, and there's certain areas up Castle Creek that have slid numerous times, and it's becoming more of a problem.
There's a two-mile stretch on Castle Creek Road that is marked as an avalanche zone, where vehicles are not allowed to stop or park because of increased danger. Gordon actually lives up that valley, above the avalanche zone.
And I've been stuck up there because the avalanche has closed off the road for a number of days.
When storms hit, it's the Pickens County crews that plow the narrow valleys, like Castle and Maroon Creeks and the Frying Pan. All drivers wear an avalanche beacon while they work, and Gordon says it's important that they know how to use them.
These guys are at risk, and I think it's really important that they're being mindful of that risk and taking precautions and doing a lot of good training for it.
Their training starts with understanding the avalanche potential, staying on top of conditions and forecasts from the Colorado Avalanche Information Center. Gordon discusses having keen situational awareness, too, paying close attention to your surroundings.
So they've got to constantly be making decisions out there in the field, and hopefully they'll be more aware thinking about avalanches and, again, the equipment that they have with them that can help save them.
Those are beacons. Much of this training is spent outside, where they stomp through the snow, practicing locating transmitters that the Mountain Rescue volunteers have buried. This simulates finding someone who has been buried in an avalanche. Scott Matice is road and bridge superintendent. He says when he started, wearing a beacon was just like putting on a belt every day, but not everyone on the team knew how to use them.
If they're using any one of our tools, anything we have, like, I want the guys to know how to use it.
In Matice's first few years with the department, they would improvise beacon practice in the parking lot of Public Works.
Hiding the beacons behind truck tires and on top of things. This is much more realistic now. We're actually stomping through the snow and kind of doing a grid search.
It's not unusual that a plow driver will come across a slide covering the road. That happens with just about every big storm, the crews say. They haven't yet had to use their equipment to locate someone buried in an avalanche, but Matice says his crews are starting to see some changing patterns, like ski tracks and shoots up Castle Creek and the Frying Pan that used to be untouched. He thinks this could have implications for the job.
The reality of us coming around a corner and seeing a snowbank with a ski sticking in it might be our reality now.
And if that ever does happen, they'll be prepared and well practiced.
That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Allison Bechtesh.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. You can find more news from the Roaring Fork Valley and from all around the world on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 to hear from NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis. She was in the Valley last week and sat down in conversation with the Aspen Institute's Kitty Boone.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.